there is a fascinating practice that has developed in the Jewish community over the past several hundred years, that in anticipation of Pesach, so Jews who have chametz in their possession that they're not ready to destroy or consume beforehand will instead sell that chametz to a non-Jew for the duration of Pesach. And it's something which many feel a little bit uncomfortable about. Is this really a legitimate fulfillment of the mitzvah of the Torah in this case? And is it really an honest-to-goodness sale? Is this really something that we mean in a genuine sense, considering the fact that we know it's pretty much always been the case that the chametz comes back to the Jews after Pesach's over? And most of us, if not all of us, have never seen anyone, any of the non-Jewish purchasers come over the course of Yontif and avail themselves of any of the chametz, which remains in our basements or in our pantries the entire time. Sorry? Someone did come. Okay, so he's entitled. Right? So did he pay for it afterwards?
What?
He paid for it. Right.
Yeah, so it was their neighbor, so he was joking.
We didn't have to joke. I mean, it is his, but he still has to pay for it. But so there is, it's rare that anyone sees that happen. So many of us feel like the whole thing is kind of a joke. And speaking of jokes, you may have heard the line somebody once said that the rabbis came out and prohibited smoking, but the Orthodox Jews aren't worried because they'll just sell their lungs to a non-Jew. So why is that a joke? So how do you decide when the sale thing works and when it doesn't work? You know, why should it work sometimes and not other times? So that's part of what we need to address here a little bit. What exactly is going on? It's interesting that we do find other areas of halacha where a sale is utilized. And sometimes it's not at all controversial, and sometimes it becomes very controversial. So Mechiras Chametz is one that is mid-level controversial. We find other things that are even more controversial. So, for example, you're probably familiar with Hetzer Mechira, right? That's a familiar concept that is one of the most controversial things that exist in the Jewish community. It was very controversial when it was first proposed about 120 years ago or so. And since then, every 7 years, it becomes a whole new controversy because just enough changes in society to kind of reinvigorate the debate, so it's as if it was being fought again from scratch. And without really without taking sides in that issue, it's just interesting. The basic premise there is that land in the land of Israel is sold into non-Jewish hands under the assumption that that will take away the prohibition of working the land during Shemitah. And many are fiercely opposed to this idea. Many great rabbis supported this idea, created this idea, supported this idea, and many others very fiercely opposed it. It continues to be a great controversy. So, is this more or less controversial than selling chametz? So it seems to be more. So it's important just to emphasize why that is, because it helps to put mechiras chametz into a more understandable context. So on the one hand, you might think mechiras chametz is actually more of a controversial idea, because mechiras chametz involves a Torah prohibition. You have a prohibition of owning chametz on Pesach. And Shemitah, nowadays, we assume is a din d'rabbanan. So from that perspective, you could think that mechiras chametz is more controversial. You're really taking a much more aggressive step in that case. But nonetheless, that factor aside, Joseph?
Why is Shemitah din d'rabbanan?
Because we assume that we need to have most of the Jews living in Israel in their ancestral homelands and in place for Shemitah to be...
Where does it say that?
It's based on the Pesukim in the Torah that you need to have Kol Yoshevei Aleha, Rov Yoshevei Aleha. So we don't have that today. And even if we have most of the Jews, that's not necessarily going to fulfill all the requirements of them being in the right Shevet. So whatever it is, Shemitah is Rabbanan today. And not everyone agrees, but that's a widespread opinion. But that fact aside, there are reasons why Mechiras Chametz is a little bit less controversial. And just to give, let's say, three examples. So, one is the concern that we're dealing here with something called a Hairama. What's a Hairama? A Hairama is probably best translated as an evasion. That this is a way of getting out of something. And we don't like that. So the term Hairama comes up in the Talmud in a number of contexts. Sometimes it's more critical, and sometimes it's a little more value neutral. But in general, it's something that we would want to avoid. So is Mechiras Chametz and Hetem Mechira, are they evasions of Allah? So it's a question. Certainly that objection is raised in the context of Mechiras Chametz. But it's worth noting that it's not the same thing as Hetem Mechira, because Hetem Mechira, the Torah says, don't work the land during Shemitah. And this is a way of being able to work the land during Shemitah. It's a way of doing the opposite of what the Torah says. While in the context of Chametz, the Torah says, don't own Chametz on Pesach. So this is a way to possibly satisfy that requirement. We're just not sure whether or not it meets the threshold. We assume don't own Chametz on Pesach means get rid of it permanently and obliterate it. And the question is, well, could it also mean transfer it to someone else and then possibly reacquire it later? So it's not that we're doing the opposite of what the Torah asks. We're just not 100% sure if it really rises to the level of what the Torah has asked for. So on that level, it's better than what we find by the Hetem Mechira. A second very major difference, and in this case I'm talking to Balabatim, by which I mean, I'm assuming we're not factory owners or supermarket owners, but people who deal with chametz in a normal consumer kind of sense. So we will not interact with this chametz over the course of the 8 days of Pesach. It will be locked away. We won't be involved with it at all. While in the case of the Hetz and Mechira, the whole point is that they will continue to have the fields work during that time. That's why they're doing it. And a third major difference, and this, you want to have a question about that? Oh, so that's what we'll get into a little bit next week. You know, the question, and not just because of chametz, but the question of what it means to have a corporation, non-owners, controllers, what's the, and that has all its implications all over the world business world. So that part we'll fill in next week. Hi. The second one is that you're not going to be involved with the chametz over the course of Pesach. Again, assuming you're a normal consumer and not a supermarket owner. The whole point is that you do want to maintain a connection to this land. You want to have it worked on your behalf. So you are involved with it while it's being sold. And the third major difference, just to get back to what Benjamin said a second ago, so what would happen if somebody, let's say the purchaser of your chametz, would decide he's interested in keeping the chametz? And he'll write you a check for the value of the chametz. You're not going to lose out any money. He'll pay for it in full. And he's going to keep it. So would you be okay with that? Probably. You wouldn't be okay with that?
He's going to keep the money, he's going to keep the food that you sold
it? Yeah, and he'll pay you for it. You had $500 worth of chametz in your house. So you sold it for Pesach, and after Pesach, the purchaser says, you know what, I'm interested in keeping the chametz, and here's a check for the $500 the chametz is worth.
How much did you pay to begin with?
Whatever is worth. Whatever. Well, he'll make it worth your while. Whatever the chametz is.
In the beginning, they sell it what? They sell their own condition that you pay $10 now.
Let me explain how that works in a minute. But that's a very important point. We'll come back to it in a second. But my basic issue is that if they end up keeping the chametz and giving you the value, so probably maybe it wasn't your first choice, but you'll be okay with that. You'll take the check and you'll go back to the supermarket after Pesach and you'll buy what you need now. However, let's say at the end of the Shemitah year, if the Arab purchaser decides, you know what, here's a check for $1 billion and we'd like to keep the land of Israel. So would we be okay with that? Okay, I'm assuming not. I'm assuming that he wouldn't be so okay with that. Hi.
In terms of the second one, just like, aren't you like getting paid or something for working the land, or just let you do it for free?
However it works, you know, whether you have workers working your land or whether you, let's say, presumably have workers working your land, But if it's not going to ultimately come back to you, you wouldn't be interested in doing it. The point is the profit from this land is going to end up coming back to Jewish hands somehow. Although the whole reason you're doing this is to allow the land to continue to be cultivated for profit. So clearly you are maintaining a connection. If you weren't going to maintain a connection, you wouldn't have any, you just leave it for the year.
Right, the way I understood the second issue was that it's that here it's like more of a joke because you're actually going to be using the thing as opposed to here you're not. Like you're using it as like a worker or something like that. You shouldn't be like
But you're also using it as an owner because if it's not going to ultimately come back to you, then
you got a worker who makes stuff off the ground.
Yeah, but the profit that you're the profit of the land ultimately is going to go back to you. Otherwise, you'd have no motive to do this.
So
even though that's not why anyone is doing the hetzer mechira, the kind of altruism. They're doing it because they're doing it. I don't want to de-emphasize when I say it's not an altruism. It's that it is out of concern for the well-being of the Israeli economy. I don't want to downplay that. I'm not taking a side against hetzer mechira here. I'm just using it to illustrate that mechiras chametz is not as radical as it could be. But motivation there is ultimately to keep the profit from this work. Hi.
Doing the book in a critical sense, if there was no hetzer mechira or mechiras chametz, how would our modern society deal with it? Because there would be no
real... Right, so the case of the hetzer mechira, which is this ongoing controversy forever, not forever, but in the past, has been an ongoing controversy for a long time, that is the question, would Israeli economy cope or would it not? And, there were those who said, yeah, it was fine in the 1800s when there was 10 Jews living in Israel and there was no government, there was no Medina. So then, they would have literally starved. So that was why they allowed it down. But now we have a government, we have millions of Jews, we have whatever, we have technology. It's not necessary. And there are others who say the opposite. Oh, now we have a whole government that relies on it, and we have a whole integrated economy that needs all this. So there's a constant back and forth about what would happen without it. Hi. Well, so the question is, the Torah has a promise about that you'll be okay. So there are those who argue that maybe that's only true when it's a real Shemitah Menat Torah, when all the other factors are in place also. There's a lot of literature about how to interpret the promise of the Torah vis-a-vis that, the whole idea. But others will, certainly make that point, that is the whole point, and deal with it, so to speak. So, that we're meant to deal with it. So that's part of the ongoing debate. Hi.
Well, in terms of the Torah saying that it will all work out, isn't that only under certain conditions?
That's what the response is. That's what the...
So we can't lean on that as credit that it's going to work
out. So that's
out.
A part of the debate, how to interpret that promise in the Torah that it's going to be okay. So, again, our topic today isn't really hetzer mechira, but it's just valuable to contrast and see if we're trying to understand mechiras chametz, to see how it's a little bit closer to the ideal than other possibilities. And, the idea of selling your lungs and smoking, so first of all, that strikes us as a joke because we know that the issue is the damage it's going to do to our lungs, which will still happen regardless of who owns them. But also, again, just in terms of this harama issue, so it's about... That is a way of being able to do the damaging action, and we're not sure if selling the chametz necessarily should be categorized that way. So do you find selling chametz in the Talmud? Not really. You find things that come close, and some things that come very close. The Gemara in Maseches Bechoros talks about a scenario where, let's say, you have an animal that's about to give birth to a firstborn animal, to a bechor. So you have a problem because the Torah says that such an animal is holy, but nowadays without a Beis HaMikdash, there's not much you can do with this animal. You can't bring it to the Beis HaMikdash, but you can't do anything else with it either. So this animal is going to be a problem. So therefore, in order to address the problem, the Talmud recommends that before the baby is born, one should go into a partnership with a non-Jew regarding the mother of the animal, and then the laws of Bechor won't apply. So in that context, the Talmud does advocate selling this animal, at least partially, to a non-Jew, apparently an attempt to avoid the halacha. But why is that not such conclusive proof for our situation, as Ilan was kind of touching upon before? Right, Chesky?
Well, because like there we're trying to do it for like a purpose, as opposed to here, it's for saving your money. Here we're doing it because we want to fulfill the will of Hashem. If we have this animal, it's like a problem to have hektish, right?
There's nothing we can do with it. We basically have a problem that we can't solve, so we're stuck, so we're doing this to avoid worse problems. But in the case of the chametz, you know, you could destroy the chametz. Well, who's stopping it? So you don't have the same compulsion. That's one possible source where you find it. The Mishnah does talk about selling chametz to a non-Jew as a way of destroying chametz, fulfilling the mitzvah of tashbisu. But there, the context seems to be that you're going to sell them for good. You know, you want to divest yourself of the chametz, so you're going to actually give it permanently through a sale to a non-Jew. And there was even an opinion of Beis Shammai that you have to make sure that you sell it with enough time for him to eat it before Pesach is going to come. That's not how we paskin, but that clearly is not talking about a possibility where you're going to reacquire it afterwards. However, there is a Tosefta, which is closest to what we do. Tosefta talks about a scenario where you're on a boat close to Pesach, and you realize it's too close to Pesach. Pesach's upon you, and you have your chametz with you that you were traveling around to sell, to do business with. So the Tosefta does say, if you have a non-Jewish fellow traveler on the boat with you, so you can transfer the property to him and reacquire it after Pesach. So that sounds very close to what we do. But what's the difference? There's no other choice, possibly, or maybe not. No other choice, but it clearly seems to be portrayed in a way that's a lot more crisis-oriented. That basically, it sounds like from the description there, that you got stuck, that it happened to you once, that you're on the boat, and you didn't plan on being on the boat, and everything took longer than you thought, and now you have your livelihood with you, and you can't just destroy your livelihood, so you have to find a way to deal with it. But what we do today is a far cry from that. And so we have built into our calendars, we know all year round, that we're going to come the weeks before Pesach and make an appointment with the rabbi and sell the chametz. And then we know it's going to come back after Pesach. And we've done this every year for our whole lives. So that's a far greater involvement than what the Tosefta talks about. And that's part of why many feel that it's not fully justified by what the Tosefta describes. Ilan?
The Tosefta could be viewed as just saying, oh, it's the case of Hefsid Merubim, again, intended not to, maybe, but nowadays, while we do intend to do it every single year, it's such a hassle to go and rebuy everything, the way we live our lives, everything they surround it. So the same case that that's the case of Hefsid Merubim, this is Hefsid Merubim.
Maybe. I mean, you know, you could plan a little better. I mean, and the idea that everyone goes every year, all the time, is certainly far more entrenched than the way that Tosefta describes it. So there were those who felt that this is not something they're comfortable with. I mean, there are those to this day who feel that way. The Beis Yosef quotes this whole idea, and he adds on a phrase that some of the Rishonim have, or Ben Yeruchim and others, that there is such a possibility that one who finds himself stuck with chametz before Pesach can transfer it to someone else. Ubilvad shelo yarim. As long as he doesn't try to pull shtick, basically. Doesn't try to evade the din. And the Beis Yosef and others questioned that, and they said, that, what do you mean, as long as you don't try to play games? The whole thing is a game. What are you saying, as long as you don't engage in any haramah? So, there are different suggestions as to what that phrase means, some of which we account for today and some of which we don't. Some of the Rishonim seem to say that it means that you shouldn't do it with what we call matana manas lahachzir. That you can give someone a gift and say, I'm giving you this gift on condition you give it back to me a day later. So there is such a concept in Jewish law, and that is considered to be a full-fledged gift during the time when the person has it. So maybe that's too much to say, I'm giving you the chametz as a gift, but you only have it on condition that you give it back to me a week from now. So that's already a little bit too much. even though, strictly speaking, from a legal sense, it probably works, because they do own it during that time, so it's not considered to be in Jewish ownership. But that's already considered to be improper. To say, I'm going to give it to you here on the condition, however, you'll give it back to me, that's already perhaps maybe what the Beis Yosef is quoting from his earlier Rishonim, that that's considered to be a harama. Hi.
Right, that's what we say by Lulav, right?
Lulav, you can do that, though.
Right. But what makes him, I mean, if it works, so what about it?
Could you say, so that's already too much of a game. That's what it sounds like. That's already, and they also add, when they comment about that, that also when it comes to Pesach, we have an attitude we're generally more machmir about things, and that this is perhaps an example of where we should be more machmir, that to allow something which is so transparent, to say that I'm giving it to you only on condition that you return it to me afterward, basically hold it for me, so that that already we're not comfortable with. Hi.
Is the Beis Yosef quoting
No, so our Mechiras Chametz really develops later. So we're talking about, but there are some of the Rishonim, by the way, though, who say, and this we don't account for, that says when it says Blavad Shelo Yarin, that you shouldn't be pulling shtick, it means that you shouldn't do it every year all the time. You shouldn't have this as part of your set schedule. That you can do it if you need to. So that clearly is not going to work so well with our current practice. By the way, Yosef, just what you said before about lulav, it's also interesting to point out that in the case of lulav, the person who wants to fulfill it needs to own it. So we could say, I give it to you temporarily, but you own it enough that you can use it. But here, it's not just that we want the other guy to own it, we want the Jew not to own it. So when the Jew says, I am divesting myself of it, but in a way that I've kind of tied a rope to it that it's going to come back, you could see why that's a little bit it's a little bit uncomfortable. That it's a little better when looked at from the other perspective. The person who's holding it temporarily to say, even though he has to get it back later, he owns it now, okay. But the guy who has to get rid of it, to say he's getting rid of it, and when he's tied a string that's going to be able to pull it back, you can see why that's not so comfortable.
You could look at it from the other perspective, though. You might say that you could see from Lulav that is considered enough of a removal to the point where
except that Lulav has no mitzvah of removal. That's the thing. Lulav is about positive ownership. While here, Chametz is not just about positive ownership, it's about you're getting rid of it. So that's not such a great getting rid of. There was a question over here before. Joseph? I'm saying that's why there are those who have pointed out that even though you could do this, to do it in this matan amanas lahatzir, to explicitly say, I'm only giving it to you on condition that you give it back, that's too much. That's not right. Another possibility, hi.
If you're saying it might not work to get out of the
maybe, not necessarily it's like a shutfus, although a shutfus might be a good way to illustrate it. Right? That let's say, theoretically, even though shutfus, again, that's the next week topic, what exactly a shutfus is, but in the case of lulav, let's say, even if without going into a shutfus, let's say you could imagine a scenario where two people own something simultaneously. So then maybe that's enough for the person to fulfill a mitzvah with it, like lulav, because he owns it. The fact that somebody else owns it, it's a little bit of a logical challenge to figure out what those words mean, but if you could make those words make sense, maybe that would be enough. But that same scenario would presumably not be enough in the case of chametz, because as much as the non-Jew owns it, the Jew owns it too. So if the Jew owns it, isn't that a problem? Isn't that so? If matana manas lahachzir is effective in making the other guy temporarily own it, it doesn't necessarily translate that it's effective in making the first guy divest himself of it. So that would be a little bit of gets involved with some other complexities, but it's closer to the first model. Okay, so another point that's raised is that maybe when we say Vavad Shelo Yarim, and this also on the surface seems to be a problem for what we do today, is that many of the earlier sources that discuss this insisted that if you're going to do this, the Chametz should be removed from the house of the Jew, should be taken out of his house and put in a non-Jew's house. So we don't seem to do that nowadays, or most of us don't seem to do that. Shouldn't say nobody. But maybe that's not so terrible, because what we do is we do rent out the part of our house where the chametz is. So maybe, perhaps on some level, that does accomplish that. And then if we also boxed it off, that part of the house, and we give the key if not the actual key, but the practical instructions of how to acquire the key to the purchaser, maybe that does address that concern. So it's a little bit of an open question. That particular interpretation of what you should not do, whether or not we address that in our contemporary settings. So I think it was Joseph Chesky.
So in the case of the lulav, the person doesn't, you're giving it to me, so I don't have to buy it from you. You say, no, I'm making it yours. It's going to be my return if you're making mine, right?
So during the time that you have it.
Right. So why can't we say that? If that's a binding sale, I mean, you wouldn't think that makes sense, because a sale is always each party gains. This doesn't make any sense. It could be an excuse to say, oh, for the sake of the mitzvah. So he's actually committing in his head to give it to him as like a gift. And now it actually belongs to him. But like, it really doesn't make sense as a transaction. You know?
Well, it depends how you define a transaction. But what you're saying here is that it's yours. I don't want to get so bogged down in the rule of issue, because it's just a little bit of a counterpoint rather than, you know, the issue that we're talking about. But the point is more just that maybe there's a concept of temporary ownership. So temporary ownership is theoretically ownership. However, here, you're including in the deal that he has to give it back to you. And if the Torah says divest it, so we're not so sure whether Mechiras Chametz meets the standard. The point is maybe it even less meets the standard if you are conditioning it explicitly that he has to give it back to you.
Basically, my giving it out of Pesach, the guy signs it, I'm buying everything for free, and then if I wanted it 8.5 days from now, so I'm going to buy it back.
Who's going to buy it back?
The Goy, I guess. Then he's going to buy it, actually. Pay anything in the beginning.
He doesn't really pay anything in the beginning, so let's talk about that for a second, how that works. But I'll explain how the mechanics. He pays very little in the beginning. You know, after we explain how it works, tell me if you still have the same question. Okay, so essentially, these are some of the issues that were brought up in terms of interpretation of that Tosefta. So there were those who maintained that they're not comfortable with this, and so there are some who, for example, have a practice that if they do Mechiras Chametz, they don't do it for the full Isser Doraisa Chametz, that they don't do it for, if it's bread, straight out bread, actual Chametz Gomer they don't sell. They sell other things that are less full-fledged prohibitions, because they're not sure this is really fully effective in terms of Torah law. There was a suggestion one of the Achronim had, the Bechor Shor, which was somewhat controversial, that he suggested that, no, we don't really have a problem of Torah law here. It's not an issue of a mitzvah d'oraisa. Why not? Isn't it a Torah prohibition to own chametz on Pesach? Chesky? Ah, because that's what the Bechor Shor says. That the Gemara says, in the beginning of Pesachim, the Gemara says that when a person is mevatel chametz, theoretically that's enough to disconnect him from the chametz on a Torah level. He no longer owns the chametz. Nonetheless, the rabbi said you should still search for whatever chametz might be around, because we're afraid, on a rabbinical level, we made a rule that we're afraid you're going to come and find the chametz on Pesach and decide you want to eat it. So we tell you to make sure your house doesn't have chametz in it. But as far as ownership, if you don't know that you own any chametz on Pesach, you think that you've gotten rid of everything, and you are mevatelit, you say you want to divorce it, essentially. So that would work on a Torah level. So the Bechor Shor's suggestion is that since you do bitul chametz, so all that's left is a rabbinic prohibition, and therefore mechiras chametz is effective for that. Jonathan?
The reason you need bittul, and you do bittul and you also need bedika, mm-hmm. So then you're doing bittul, but you're saying you're doing bittul, but your stomach's not working, so you need to take that out of your chest anyway.
So if this is what you're asking, I'm not sure if this is what you're asking exactly, but... okay. So basically, many objected to this view of the Bechor Shor, so it's not really accurate. That what you are doing is your mevatel chametz and you sell chametz, it's not the same chametz. The chametz that you sell and the chametz that you're mevatel is two different sets. You sell the chametz that you would hope to reacquire later. The chametz that you're being mevatel, you're not going to do business with that chametz. You're not going to be selling that to anyone. That's the crumbs under the couch that you don't even know are there and that you don't expect to ever see again. So that you say, in case there's a pretzel that's under the chair somewhere, I declare that it's meaningless. But I'm not going to then do business with that pretzel. So that's how many assume that we're talking about two different groups here, and therefore you have to kind of man up and say that if you're willing to get behind this, you have to get behind it on a level of Minat Torah. You can't say, well, it's only the Rabbanan because of the Bittul, and therefore that's going to be enough. Ilan?
Why couldn't one simply do a half gear? Let's say that my chutz is not going to acquire it, half gear. Anyone that happens to walk into my house and see it can take it.
Because no one has access to your house. If you happen to leave, you know, you're going to leave full packages of bread in your basement, which is protected, you know, and is then your property. So you're the one who acquires it, even if you say it's hefker. Now, there are Rishonim who maintain that bittul is some form of hefker. It's a machlokes Rishonim in general, whether there is a correlation between bittul and hefker. But still, again, that's going to apply to the chametz that you basically are not actively trying to protect. You know, you're not keeping in take down packages in the closet. You understand? The bittul is less meaningful. That when you normally say bittul, you really mean I don't want to ever see this chametz again. And now to say that chametz that you're selling is also included in the bittul, it doesn't sound like a meaningful bittul anymore. Agreed. Pesky?
I just wanted to know, you keep quoting from the Yosef. Mm-hmm. So you actually bring it, like, he codifies the Chokhlar calls to be possible this way.
He codifies what the Tosefta says, that theoretically a person who finds himself in a fix can sell the chametz. And then the question is, our practice.
The
Harama
aspect.
He does. He quotes it. He quotes, but he says he asks on it because he says it seems like the whole thing is the Harama.
Well, he himself does.
Yeah, but even so, the widespread practice that we have of the formalized calendar identified sale that everyone in the community does is a later development. So that. So that prompts the question again. So is this something that we're comfortable with? Or should there be such concerns that maybe we should say that this doesn't really affect what we're trying to affect? So first of all, just what actually happens, just to address what Joseph brought up before. So if any of you have ever witnessed the Mechiras Chametz, so it's worth witnessing, it's a fascinating thing to see, that basically we want to make sure that the transaction actually takes effect. And we're not 100% sure, there's many different kinyanim in halacha, and we're not 100% sure which kinyanim are valid in this context. In terms of a transaction between a Jew and a non-Jew, you have two different legal systems at play here, and we want to make sure that it's effective, not only in an external sense, but it's effective on a level of min ha-Torah, to address a mitzvah min ha-Torah. So our practice is that we do as many different types of kinyanim, as many different transaction methods as we can accomplish here. So among the methods, we use a handshake, because a handshake is what's called a situmta. That means if you have a conventional method of sealing a deal in that culture, so that also is considered to be a kinyan. So in America, people seal a deal with a handshake, so therefore that's one of the ways we do it. We have a kinyan called a kinyan chalipin. That I'm sure you've all seen when you lift up a knife or a watch or something like that. So we do that too, just in case that's effective. We also have a kinyan called kinyan agav, which means that if you're selling land, you can also use that same transaction to also move movable property at the same time. So since we also rent out where the chametz is, while we're doing that transaction, we're also able to transfer the property. We use contracts, so that's a shtar. That's also a type of kinyan. And we use money. We use kinyan kesef. So what does that mean? This is what Joseph was asking about before. So the purchaser pays a token amount, which, let's say, would represent a cent or two per seller. A small amount. Now, that's what we call in halacha kinyan kesef. How does the kinyan kesef work? So let's say I want to buy a house with a kinyan kesef. So the house, let's say, costs $500,000. And I use a kinyan kesef, I put down a quarter. So some understood that to be essentially a down payment. So now I owe $499,999.75. And others said, no, it's not even a down payment. It doesn't correspond at all to any value. It's more symbolic. How do we know that's true? Because where else do we find the Kinyan Kesef used in contemporary life? Kiddushin. So when somebody gets married, they do a Kinyan Kesef. We have a practice of using not actual money, but using something that's worth money, i.e. a wedding ring. So the wedding ring is a way of effecting a Kinyan Kesef. So at the Sma, on the side of the page of the Shulchan Aruch says, are you going to tell me that that's towards the price, purchase price of the woman? She has no purchase price. She's priceless. So clearly it doesn't correspond to any monetary value. And it's the same Kinyan Kesef in all areas of Halacha. So if it works in Kiddushin, it can't be that it's a down payment towards the purchase value. There is no purchase price. So too, when you use it anywhere else, it's more symbolic than it is a down payment. So this guy doesn't owe $499,000, he owes $500,000. He owes the whole purchase price, whatever it is. But here's the crucial kicker. So when you sell this house, or whatever, let's use that model for a second. So it's not the case that the purchaser only owns it once he pays off the whole price, or only owns it conditionally if he pays off the whole price. Because then we'd be in real trouble when it comes to chametz. Because the chametz that you're selling, let's say it's worth, it could be worth a lot. You have a congregation of a lot of people, you have a lot of congregations coming together, it could add up to a lot of money. So let's say the chametz is worth $1 million. So the purchaser says, okay, so now I'll pay you $1 million for the chametz. And you tell him that you transfer the property 100% irrevocably with all of those transactions that we did. But now he owes the purchase price. He owes what's rest. It's as if it was a loan. The $1 million that he hasn't paid yet, it's as if he was loaned $1 million and he owes it. But his payment or lack of payment does not negate the sale. If he never pays it, the sale is still good, but he owes $1 million and he has to pay. So we'll say to him, listen, you have a week to come up with $1 million. If after a week you decide you don't want to come up with $1 million, you don't want to pay that much, so then we'll release you from your obligation if you give back all the chametz. So the way this would work, for example, if people have their furniture foreclosed, you don't pay for your bought your couch on an installment and you don't pay for it, so the guy comes and repossesses it. So the way that would be framed is that it's not that you never owned the couch and now the store is taking it back because you hadn't paid the rest of the debt. You owned the couch from the very beginning. The moment they gave you the couch to take home, it was your couch. But you have a debt to the store to pay the value of the couch. And the law gives them a remedy that if you're not paying them, so in order for them to be able to get what's due to them, they're allowed to come and take back the couch instead of in lieu of the fact that they're not getting paid. So, but it shouldn't be viewed as if it wasn't your couch the whole time because you didn't finish paying for it, so therefore they're not taking it back. Because if that's what happens when it comes to chametz, we'd be in big trouble. Because it would retroactively come out that we never actually sold the chametz. And that would be really bad. Then we owned chametz over Pesach. So in order to emphasize that that's not the case, it's important to understand that the chametz was theirs, was the purchaser's 100%, and he gives it back after Pesach instead of having to pay the purchase price. But that does not negate the sale retroactively. In terms of, if it was a loan, right? That gets back to what we talked about last week.
You gave him all the chametz.
First of all, you're allowed to transact the business with the non-Jew, so that's not a prohibition anyway. But even if it wasn't, that wouldn't be an issue here because you're not lending it; you sold it to him. So this is more comparable. If there was a ribbis issue, just theoretically, we spoke about last week, about or 2 weeks ago, I guess it was, about is refund policy a problem in terms of ribbis? So it all depends on how it's phrased. If it means that it's as if the sale is negated, so that would be a problem for ribbis in that context, and it'd be a problem for chametz in this context. But if it doesn't mean that the sale is negated, but it means that you're buying it back afterwards, so then that eliminates both problems. Ilan?
So, well, we can go through and explain why it really is a valid sale, and you have all the functions. Would one still say that if I feel that it's still good, but it's not like hot good.
So it's a debate. I don't necessarily think it's a problem. I'll explain why ultimately it's in our discussion. But it continues to be somewhat controversial. Hi.
Isn't there, are you not supposed to get hana from clients?
Yes.
Can that include mental hana?
Mental hana such as what? I mean, probably
you
not.
Yourself, oh, I have I own a wine factory.
But you don't. You sold it.
Yeah, but I'm getting it back. I know I'm getting it back. That's the way.
So you're saying that good feeling is hana? That's not
a 100%. The guy is saying, like, I own a wine factory. It's my factory.
Yeah, I don't think, have it back. I don't think that really counts as the kind of hana that we prohibit. I mean, if he's trying to, you know, he's trying to impress the girls with the Pesach program that he's going at and saying, you know, I own this huge, you know, even that would technically be permissible anyway, because he's not, we're very roundabout hana, but it's an interesting example. Hi.
Even in your head, just to say,
yeah, that's definitely not a quantifiable hana that we would,
Is there, I know we talked about before, about if there's a certain understanding that's being, like in previous, class of what he's talking about, if there is just a basic understanding of how things are done, a certain sense of, you know, this, whether it's what you're putting into the ethics or how you know, we don't do X, Y, or Z in this type of business, could you say that for such a transaction that it's understood that the person is going to receive what he's selling back in return, and therefore if the person he sold it to doesn't return it, that maybe that person, the non-Jew, might be in violation of some sort of, standard.
I think if that were the understanding, then that would be closer to the Matana Manas Lahatsu that the Rishonim spoke out against. And I think for a lot of reasons we'd be uncomfortable with any kind of such implicit or explicit arrangement. It's old. If he chooses he wants to keep it, let him keep it. He has to pay for it. It's not an extortionary payment. You know, the money that you're going to charge is the money the chametz is really worth. You know, it's not like some kind of trick that you'll make the value $1 billion so he'll never want to do it. You make the value whatever the chametz actually is, and if he chooses to buy it and pay the market value, then fine. Then, you know, that'll be okay. And if not, also okay. And that's the proper attitude to have. So, in any event, just to say a few more details here, it's also interesting just in terms of the evolution of the practice. So, there is a big discussion. One of the things that was added into this equation in the past few hundred years, also somewhat controversially, what's another major difference between what we do today and what's described in the Tosefta? We're on the boat, yes. But besides that, who's doing the selling in the Tosefta? Well, so in the case of the Tosefta, the boat, the guy in the boat, so the guy selling his own chametz. Right, so nowadays, most of us do not sell our own chametz, but, or we do not interact with the non-Jewish purchaser at all. And we do something or another with a rabbi. And the rabbi does something or another with the purchaser. So who's doing, what are the something or another? What's going on? So the role of the rabbi, which again is a relatively recent phenomenon, only the past few hundred years. So what exactly is going on? What is the rabbi there for? So there are those who understood it, less commonly today, but there was such an idea, that the congregants go to the rabbi and sell it to him. And the rabbi then sells it to the non-Jew. So that has a lot of problems to it. Because, as we mentioned, the whole transaction is a little complicated to make sure you successfully have transferred the property. And it's a lot easier when you're dealing Jews within Jews, because it's all one legal system. So what's very conceivable is the congregants may successfully sell their chametz to the rabbi, and the rabbi may unsuccessfully sell it to the non-Jew. So basically all we've accomplished is keeping the chametz in Jewish hands the entire time. But right, so it's basically a kind of a Christian view of the rabbinate, so he'll take on the sins of the entire congregation, but it's not really going to help in the long run. And the chametz is still going to be prohibited after Pesach.
Since it's an extra step, like why have the extra step? Another
and what does it accomplish? It puts all the sins in his pocket, but that's, you know, maybe, again, some Balabatim have this attitude that let's just empty all our problems onto the rabbi, but that's not really the goal of Mechiras Chametz. So, hi, Chesky.
And the point of Bin to, because like, he knows what he's doing, as opposed to every boss who doesn't necessarily understand the situation.
That's definitely a big part of it. But still, having them sell it to him would seem to be a dangerous, unnecessary step.
I'm saying in terms of, let's say, he's the shliach, like, this is the reason why we deviate from the percent.
So, right, so the way we do it today is that we have him act on behalf of people. That's how most understand it. Again, there's a lot of literature about this. But that the basic process is that he is appointed as the agent to sell the chametz on behalf of his people. So he never actually takes ownership of the chametz. He is granted authority by his congregants, and with that authority, he is able to effect the transaction of the chametz to the purchaser. So that's a very different model, which we'll have to discuss. Hi.
What's the potential issue with you sell to the rabbi?
That what happens if you're successful in selling it to the rabbi, which is easier than selling it to the non-Jew, and then the non-Jew, you're not, so the rabbi is not successful in selling it to the non-Jew. Because the Kenyan may be mistaken. It's very possible to make a mistake in the transaction. Like, let's say, for example, let's say he thinks that it should be a down payment that's going to be what we described before, that the sale will be negated if you have to pay the whole thing. Yeah, let's say he makes a mistake.
But either way, that could happen, whether he's a shliach or...
Yeah, but all we're gaining by having it go through him first is that he ends up acquiring it all personally, and that keeps the chametz in Jewish hands, just in two hands, as opposed to 200 hands.
Yeah, but you don't have to worry. I mean, is it two hands, or is it a new pair of hands?
But it's a new, if you're selling it to him, then
right.
He ends up owning all the chametz. That's not.
I'm saying as an individual, then like honestly, I should care about the rabbi, but like.
Right. So you get off easy. You don't know.
Right.
Right, but that doesn't necessarily help.
I mean, okay, but then
and your chametz will be prohibited after Pesach. So
oh, so, I understand.
Because it's going to be chametz.
So that's the issue.
That's two problems. I mean, hopefully the rabbi's soul is also a problem. But in addition
to
that...
that's like not a new problem. I mean,
right.
If there was a problem in the Kenyan for you between you and the rabbi, you know, that's just also a problem.
But you're right. You're not accomplishing anything in terms of your chametz. So that's not going to really... There's no real purpose in that, in transferring it to another Jew, so it ends up
being... We're not
being,
any more sure that our Kenyan rabbi is working more.
Sorry?
We're not even more sure that our Kenyan is working than if we sold the rabbi and he sold it, right?
Correct. The last step could still go wrong. But we don't gain anything by...
Well, isn't the reason that we sell to rabbi because they understand, like, Kenyanim?
That's what
we do.
Yeah, that fact that...
The overview, it's better that one guy sees two Kenyanim and knows what he's doing, than one guy who doesn't know what he's doing.
So that's why we can agree that it's probably a good development that the rabbi does the transaction with a non-Jew. The question is, in what capacity should he do this? As the owner, because he bought it all from his congregants? Or as an agent, in which case he never has to actually own it himself. He is just representing his congregants and selling it from them to the purchaser. And that's usually how you do it today. He doesn't buy it from them. He acts on their behalf to sell it for them. And that has a lot of advantages to it. It's not all upsides, but for the most part it has advantages. One of the issues that is better served that way is in general, so the rabbi would presumably like the people should come in a staggered form, doesn't want to have to deal with all of his congregants the day before Pesach. But in general, it's advisable to do this as close as possible to Pesach. Why? Well, if you were selling it to the rabbi, and then let's say you want to purchase more chametz in between now and Pesach, so it would really be difficult to consider that included in the sale. Because you can't sell stuff that you haven't purchased yet. There might be a way to do it, but for the most part, that's problematic. So that would really be hard to say that any chametz purchased afterwards, let's say you make these appointments 2 weeks before Pesach. So if you want to get anything in those 2 weeks, it's going to be hard to say that that's a part of the sale. However, if you authorize him to sell chametz on your behalf, so then it's less of a problem because you can still, you want to be as close as possible to Pesach. And it's still an interesting question whether or not you can authorize a sale of something that hasn't happened yet, but it's a little bit less problematic. Just to finish this point, though, it's also when you describe to him what you're selling, so you want that description to be as accurate as possible. So again, the closer you are to Pesach, the better off you are from that. You understand?
Is one of the
Kenyanim
like Pinchaser?
Yeah, so then also, so now he... theoretically, if he, but the question is, how do you transfer even the chatzar? I guess you could transfer because.
So it first and then
right.
put it in there.
See, that's also an interesting question, how they did that in those days. If they did it as the rabbi, as a purchaser, so they sold the chutz, they rented the chutz. I'm not even sure how they dealt with the chutz in those days. If you make him the agent, it's all much easier. On the flip side, though, one thing that's better serviced if he's the purchaser is if the person who made the arrangement with the rabbi dies before Pesach. So in addition to all the other problems, you also have a problem with the chametz, because presumably he's no longer authorized to sell this chametz. The chametz now went to the inheritors, and the inheritors didn't authorize him, so he probably can't sell the chametz, which is unfortunately one more thing for them to worry about during their avelos period, because that's going to be a problem. While if he had actually sold it to the rabbi, then the rabbi would have the actual ownership, and then he could sell it and he could deal with it afterwards. But that's kind of an unlikely scenario. It's not enough to justify doing it that way. So if the congregants are not actually selling it to the rabbi, so then why do they do the whole thing with lifting up of a handkerchief? And then they come to the rabbi, they fill out the form, he tells them to lift up a watch or a handkerchief or something like that. So why does he do that? So that's not to affect the sale, because they're not selling it to him. That is so that we can appoint him a messenger. And the Rambam writes, in a different context, not talking about the chametz, but the Rambam says that this is really kind of a meaningless thing that we do, but we want people to take it seriously, so we put our ritual there, that they should lift up something, as they should feel like something's actually happening, but really you don't need it. So really you could appoint a rabbi shliach without doing that, which has ramifications for the modern era. So theoretically, you can appoint a rabbi through the internet or through a fax. You could probably, or on the phone, you could theoretically, but even better on the internet or a fax, because you want to have something in writing, but you can do it without being in physical proximity to them. And that does happen. People are in a different location, and that's the only way to do things. Still, we prefer to have the face-to-face meetings, but theoretically, it is possible to create this appointment even remotely, and it's not actually crucial to have this physical transaction take place the way it does, because he's not actually purchasing it. Now, it's an interesting question. One of the rabbi's nightmares, what happens if he loses all the forms? So his very rich balabatim with millions of dollars of chametz have trusted him to sell the chametz and to keep their millions of dollars from getting lost, and he lost the forms. And there's no way he's going to go back and get them again. So I get them all written again. He's on the way to make the purchase now. So Rabbi Asher Weiss talks about this in one of his essays in his Haggadah. And he notes that theoretically it's not really a problem, because theoretically it is possible to sell something in the let's make a deal fashion, where you say, okay, you want to buy what's behind door number two, even though you don't know what it is. You want to sell a grab bag of mysterious contents. So theoretically, it is possible to do that. So it is possible to say, I'm selling you all my congregants' chametz and you have no idea how much it's worth. Are you willing to buy it? Theoretically, you could do that. It's just we don't like doing that because, for reasons as we'll discuss and continue to discuss, we want the sale to be as authentic as possible. So ideally, we will write out on the paper what the chametz is generally, how much it's worth, etc., etc. So the purchaser has, as much as possible, a real idea of what it is he is acquiring. But if you can't do that, if the forms are lost, so then theoretically the sale is still possible. So I would also maybe recommend that the rabbi actually say to the purchaser, here are the forms of the people who have appointed me as their agent. Are you interested in buying them? And are you also interested that if it should be that anyone appointed me and their form's not here, it got lost, or whatever, that should also be included in the sale. You should also know that anyone who empowered me to sell the chametz, I'm selling it to you.
In the sale, the person, the goy that's buying them, we have to just check into make sure he has enough money, because he's not paying it all up front, correct?
So, most people don't. Happens to be that many people in the New York area do sale with a Willie, and he has a long-standing relationship with Mr. John J. Brown, who purchases his chametz, his real name, and he is a real estate agent and a businessman, and there are a couple of reasons why he prefers to do it with him. One reason is because he's somebody who's trained in transactions and purchases, and he really understands what's happening, so that also helps, but Also, as a businessman, it's more feasible that if he wants, and he decides that he wants to make a business out of keeping all this chametz and selling it, then he could probably get a few friends together and figure out how to pay for it. When if you're dealing with somebody who's not in that category, it's a little bit less likely, so makes it a little bit less of a serious type of thing. If you know the person could never, under any circumstances, be able to end up paying for this, there is something a little bit insufficient as far as that's concerned. Doesn't necessarily mean, though, that you have to actually take on the responsibility of making sure they can. It means that, all right, so then it's theoretically a sale to somebody who can't afford it is also valid, just to end up in trouble later. That's how we got into the whole economic crisis in America. Everyone sold houses without checking if people could actually afford it. So the sale went through, but the economy collapsed. Hi.
Okay. So actually, this thing about the chalipin.
Mm-hmm.
So I've heard that is one explanation for why people give the rabbi money is to make them like a shliach. They give money. People have money to give money.
Yeah, so if you, so there are many explanations as to why people have a practice to give the rabbi money. One of them is that to make a shliach in a sense that you can rely that it happened, because the Gemara has a discussion in general that if you ask somebody to do something for you, so do you have the right then to assume that it happened? You say shliach osa shechuso. So one possibility is that if he's doing you as a favor, then you can't necessarily rely that it actually happened. But if he's paid to do it, then you can rely that he actually did it. So it strengthens the reliability of the shlichus, so some have explained it based on that.
That's going to be a chalipin.
No, more right. It's less serious in the sense that it's not really required. It's a chumrah, let's say, or, you know, it's a practice that some people have taken on, but it relates to a different component of it. All right, so what if the sale is ineffective? So that's a problem. We want to make sure the sale is effective. If the sale is ineffective, so in addition to violating Bali Ra, Bali Matze, a Torah prohibition, you violated Peshogeg, again, it was inadvertent because you thought you were addressing it, but it's still a bad thing. But you also presumably have a problem that the Chametz afterwards should be prohibited.
Even though it was sold?
Well, if it wasn't sold, let's say you tried to sell it, but you made a mistake in the transaction, and you realize afterwards that it wasn't actually sold. So then, theoretically, the chametz should be prohibited afterwards. However, there are ways to address that if it comes up. You should look into it. That prohibition is a rabbinical prohibition. The prohibition is Rabbanan, so it's already a little bit of a lower threshold. And there were those who suggested that maybe even an ineffective sale is effective on some level, because maybe even if it's ineffective as a sale, maybe you could view that as a form of bittul, that you tried to get rid of it. Basically tried to throw it out the window, and you didn't realize the window was closed, so it bounced back in. So, but you thought you were throwing it out the window, so there were those who thought there was room to say that even an ineffective sale, at least to rely on it after the fact in terms of the rabbinic prohibition, maybe you could see it as a form of bittul. Again, not saying that as a final conclusion, but there is such a discussion. Avi?
Does that tie into those who have the opinion that you can't really sell red, you sell kind of like red-related products?
It's not necessarily
a stretch because you really
you're lowering the level of the prohibition to begin with. That's the only way in which it impacts a little bit.
No, because in case you didn't get rid of anything, you're not really sure if
see, that's another reason why you would not want to get involved with bread, because you're not sure if the sale is going to be perfect.
Okay,
so there's a couple more points I want to make about this, but I want to keep this to a one session discussion in the interest of time. So, what I'll do is I'll get to my key point now, and then if we have 2 minutes, I'll add another point or two about the details here. But I do want to address from a little bit of a philosophical, ethical perspective, so what is the story here? So why has there been the widespread practice among the Jewish people in the past few hundred years to rely on this, if it does have so many holes, so to speak, or if we're dealing with a Torah prohibition, and you know that purchaser never ends up picking it up with their Pesach, you always end up getting it back, you don't even take it out of your house. Why is it that so many wonderful Jews have been comfortable with this approach? So I think one could say as follows, that we have this prohibition of owning chametz on Pesach. Why do you have such a prohibition? So that's a good question. So the Ran, one of the Rishonim in the commentary to the Seches Pesachim, the first Daf in Pesachim, the Ran says that the reason the Torah prohibited owning Chametz on Pesach actually is not a fundamental reason. The Torah doesn't really care about us owning Chametz on Pesach. The Torah really doesn't want us to eat Chametz on Pesach. So why does the Torah say, Bal Yirah, Bal Yimatzeh, that we shouldn't own Chametz on Pesach? So according to the Ran, the reason is because we're afraid that you might come to eat the Chametz on Pesach. So how come we don't have such a prohibition by other things? Right, why don't we say that you're prohibited to own pork? Maybe you'll come to eat it. So there's two answers. One is that pork is a lower level prohibition, but also...
usually eat chametz the rest of the year, so it's more likely...
50, right. 51 weeks a year you eat chametz. So if you wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning hungry, you may... there's a loaf of bread in your fridge, so then there's a good possibility to make yourself a peanut butter sandwich. If there's a pork in your fridge for whatever reason, it's less likely that you'll make yourself a pork sandwich because you never do. But a peanut butter sandwich, maybe that you will do. So, therefore, says the Ran, so in order to keep us away from eating chametz on Pesach, the Torah says, not only should you not eat it, but as a safeguard from the Torah itself, which apparently exists, as others have pointed out, you shouldn't even own the chametz in the first place. So perhaps the custom developed because of the following principle. But if we're trying to prevent ourselves from eating chametz on Pesach, so there's two ways to do it. One way is to not have access to any. Or another way is that maybe we will have access, but if we know that this chametz belongs to someone else, that if we would take any, we'd be stealing, it would be a violation of lo sigzol, this is the property of someone else, so we are so respectful of that, of the property rights of another person, that that will also keep us away from eating chametz on Pesach. But essentially, we're making a statement that we value the honesty and integrity of our business dealings so much that we're willing to stake our kares, we're willing to stake our souls on this, and that we're confident that that respect for property ownership will keep us away from eating someone else's chametz, eating chametz at all, just as much as not having it in the first place. It's a very powerful statement. And therefore, it doesn't matter if it's going to come back to us after Pesach. And it doesn't matter if it's sitting in our house. And it doesn't matter if the purchaser has not come and removed it. The fact is, right now it is technically the property of someone else. And you only need it to be technically the property of someone else in order for there to be a prohibition of stealing. So if there's a prohibition of stealing, we don't care what's going to happen later. We don't care where it's sitting. All we care about is that you're in violation of stealing if you take it. And that's enough to keep us away. And especially, I think we mentioned in our first class, at the Smag, in the Sefer Mitzvahs, in Siman Ayin Gimel, the Smag maintains that why is it that the exile has gone on for so long? Why is it that the Jews have been in exile for so long? It's that because they're not honest enough in their business dealings. That if the Jews are known for integrity in a public way, so then there can be a redemption. But if the Jews are not known as people who are publicly honest, so then God can't bring a redemption to the Jewish people because the nations of the world will say, why is God redeeming a nation like this? It's a chilul Hashem. It's a disgrace. Why is he redeeming these immoral people and holding them up as his flag bearer? So therefore, says the Smag, when's it going to be that they'll have a redemption when people, the Jews, are known for being honest and faithful? So that's when God will be able to redeem us. Hi.
Does Yeshiva believe that? Does this Yeshiva?
I believe so.
So our general, most Yeshivas, like if you look around New York area and you look at the names, I mean even on this building downstairs, there are a lot of people that you would say really are the opposite of that.
I hope that's not the case. I don't. You know, I can't speak on behalf of individuals, and I certainly wouldn't want to name any individuals.
Is there a cohesive group of Rebbeim, or the Rebbeim is it acknowledged among the Rebbeim that this is something that needs to be done and needs to be acted upon?
I think I can't speak on behalf of any of the specifics because you know, certainly in other places I can't speak on behalf of anything. And I don't know the specific you're referring to, and I wouldn't want you to go into more detail. But I think the general belief is that that should certainly be. I hope that's the general belief.
Is there any room for leniency? Like, you know, they're paying for the yeshiva, so it's okay.
So it's okay to what? It's okay to act dishonestly, or it's okay? No, that's for sure not.
Okay.
The question is just. Sorry? No, the question is, if somebody has acted dishonestly, so can their name be on a building, which is a much more complicated topic. So that depends what? It depends how dishonest they are. You know what I mean? What I mean by how dishonest, it means, does this permeate their whole identity, that everyone looks at this person and says, this person's a thief? Or has this person done one thing wrong, but they've done many other good things, so therefore they don't necessarily personify that type of quality. And then if the money that they have is actually stolen, so then that money can't be given towards any charitable cause. But sometimes that's not the case. Sometimes the person, most of his money or even all of his money, is legitimately acquired. He has other things which are disreputable. So then it becomes a judgment call when it's appropriate to honor such a person in such a way and recognize their contributions. So that becomes a complex judgment call. We have to hope we make the right judgment call. But there's certainly... the overall goal is that we should represent honesty and integrity, and hopefully that's what emerges, even when taking all the factors into consideration and recognizing that it's not always possible to make a perfect decision. But that is our hope. Our hope is that that will be both the reality and the perception. And sometimes the perception is worse than the reality, but then there's only so much you can do to control that, which is a different subject. But you first start with yourself and hope that that will also be the perception that will emerge from that. So if that's all true, so perhaps we could suggest that, a little bit Derech HaDrush, but maybe there's truth to it, that the Jews developed a practice, specifically Pesach time, the time we talk about the redemption, we talk about the Geula, and we focus on past and future Geulas. So we say, this is a time when it's a good idea, we will proactively enter into a transaction with the Umas Olam, and we will go out of our way to make sure that that is as legitimate and honest as possible. And we will show, we will stake our whole spiritual well-being on the validity of that transaction and on the integrity of that transaction. So perhaps that's a little bit the mentality, both what is effective in terms of the Bali Ra, Bali Matze, and why it's not only effective, it may be even a positive value, maybe it's a way of honing and displaying this sense of honesty and integrity at a time when we're focused on our hopes for redemption. So which questions were, I think it was Yonatan Ben Ariel, does that make sense? I saw a couple hands up before.
Is that the same, pretty much the same thing we're saying about Heather Isco, what, that we, as long as we take care of like the spirit of the law, then as long as we can do the technical sale, or here, as long as we do the technical sale.
I think in general, we're always looking to accomplish both. We're always looking to make sure that we are addressing both the spirit and the letter of the law. That's why we started off in the beginning of the semester, saying that in addition to the letter of the law, we want to be able to perceive the spirit of the law so we can go with Nimbus Shur Sadin. In the case of Heter Iska, so when there is a strong need to transact in a certain way, we want to make sure that it addresses both the letter of the law, as with the Heter Iska, and the spirit of the law, and being that it's only a scenario which we understand to be consistent with the spirit of the law. And so to here, so the spirit of the law of chametz, we assume is, according to the Ran at least, to keep us away from eating chametz. And therefore, maybe this addresses the letter of the law in a way that also is effective for the spirit of the law. And maybe it also has an affirmative value in that maybe going out of our way to have such transactions that are upheld in their full honest sense is itself a positive value. So that being the case, just a few minutes to add on a few more words. So I think it's important that the attitude that we should have is one that this is a full legitimate sale for all intents and purposes, and you shouldn't take it casually. There is a discussion posts can have that comes up all the time. Everyone has every rabbi gets this question at least once a year, that somebody, over the course of Pesach, he opens up a closet and he finds a bottle of whiskey there, something that he doesn't remember that he had, and he didn't put it away with he didn't put it away with the sold materials. So what should he do? So there are poskim who maintain, okay, that he probably didn't sell this, therefore he should destroy it. It's chametz in his property, he should get rid of it. On chalamoy, let's say. Just to simplify
that.
Let's simplify that. The Gemara talks about if you find chametz in your house on Yontif, you should cover it up and then destroy it. So here, but the Gemara is talking about before there was mechiras chametz. So now, let's say so you sold the chametz, and you find this bottle in your house, you find whatever, a loaf of bread in your Plaza, even though not. So, as many poskim also expressed, a different view, and I think there's a lot to be said to this view, is that it's very questionable to do that, because chances are that you really sold this bottle of wine. Because when we make the shtar, the chametz, so we don't say that I'm selling you only the chametz that I'm describing on this piece of paper that is in my closet, in my pantry, or whatever it is. You say, I sell you all the chametz I have. Now you want to know where the chametz is, so you can come and get it if you want. So therefore, I'm going to tell you where it is, and here's how you get it, and here's where the key is, etc., etc. But the listing of the chametz is not meant to be exclusive, to say that any chametz that's not listed here, I'm not selling. So therefore, the whiskey bottle you presumably also sold. So therefore, this very likely is the property of the non-Jewish purchaser. So if you're going to destroy it, you're essentially doing an act of gzeila, an act of nezek, you're destroying somebody else's property. Now, one might say, well, maybe that's true, maybe it's not true, but just in case, it's safer to destroy it, because even if it is his, he'll probably be Michael. He'll probably be okay with it. So, that may be true, that he'll probably be Michael, but I think if you're too quick to take the attitude that he'll be Michael so I could take it, that's going to undermine everything about what the Mechiras Chametz is. The Mechiras Chametz should be about that you have a mentality that he's not mochel, that I assume this is somebody else's property, and I treat it like somebody else's property. And I'm not going to take it upon myself to assume that he's okay with my destroying it, taking it for myself, or whatever. Because if you have that attitude, then the whole thing falls apart, both in terms of the legitimacy of the sale itself, and also in terms of it being effective in keeping you away from eating the chametz. So I would highly recommend that in all of our attitudes towards the chametz in our house over Pesach, that we should have the attitude, this is somebody else's property, it happens to be in my house right now, but it's somebody else's, I'm not allowed to take it, destroy it, eat it, do any of those things, because I would be in violation of the gezeil. Hi.
In regards to the room that you're also renting at the makom, so what happens if I put it in our storage closet downstairs and happens to be where we also keep other things, the bedding for extra guests, or guests come over also and we realize, oh shoot, that room's all taped up, is everything else in that room us, or would it be one of that?
Yeah, so you generally try to keep it a little bit more isolated, but technically speaking, that would be a little more of a jump to say that becomes prohibitive. So I think it's safer to assume he doesn't intend to acquire that, and that's not included in what I just said a minute ago, that you don't want to assume that he's mochel on to Ariel.
Yeah, in regards to the thing that we can be more honest with our business interactions, because of Kohler Brios, they always hate us anyways, whatever we do. So it's not like there's ever going to be a Kohler Brios.
I don't know if that's true. I hope that's not true.
I mean, the Arabs, they love us?
I'm not talking necessarily about the Arabs, but the people in general, perception of the world, but it's also addressed that a little bit, that we're not always in control of perception, but sometimes the perception will be one way regardless, that definitely happens.
It is, right?
Sometimes I don't want to necessarily take a fatalistic attitude that it has to always be that way, but sometimes that's true, so you can't always take full responsibility for the perception, but you have to do what you can to start from the middle. The first Rashi in Chumash says that the Torah starts off with the creation of the world because it'll come to be that the nations of the world will say to the Jews, you stole the land of Israel. So the Torah starts off telling us that God created the world. He has the right to give it to who he wants. So if that's the truth, so then why do we need to have the whole crisis in the Middle East? Let's just have Netanyahu pull out his article of Chumash with a translation in English, and he'll tell Obama that's what Rashi says, and the whole thing will be over. And they'll tell Abbas, it's the Rashi and Chumash, and it's all done. So clearly Obama and Abbas are not going to be influenced by Rashi and Chumash, so then what's the point? So as many have explained, the point is not for them, the point is for us, that we have to know that we're dealing honestly. Hopefully the rest of the world will also catch on and they'll recognize it for what it is.
So we are reviewing the land, we missed that, it's rosy.
I understand the concern you have in general about how that specific transaction, how that specific interaction has been so far, but that doesn't change the point. But our primary responsibility is to act in a honest and faithful way, and it's not always possible to control how it's perceived, but we do what we can. And the first step is that it should be that way, and then hopefully it will be perceived that way. It's certainly true, and I know many such instances where you can't control the perception. But that's our primary responsibility. So we'll just add one other shayla, we have 2 minutes left. It's interesting, there's also a question that's raised in some svarim. I think the question is a little bit better than the answer. That if we put in our shtaros, that we're selling all the liquor and all the medicines. So someone pointed out that it's against the din of the malchusa, because you're not allowed to sell liquor without a license, and you can't sell medicine without a license. So some posts can say, well, yeah, but this is only a ritual sale, so it's okay. So I'm not comfortable with that attitude also, for the same reason. I think that we should see this as an absolute sale, which would ideally conform to the din of the malchusa. So I think the answer, to the extent that it exists, is probably different for liquor and for medicines. That when it comes to liquor, it's probably true the government really isn't makbid, not because it's only ritual, but because the purpose of the liquor license is you shouldn't open up a bar or a liquor store without a license. But if, let's say, somebody has a half a bottle of wine he doesn't want anymore, and his neighbor says, "I'll give you $5 for it," presumably that's not, I assume, that's not a legal violation. So here, in that context, the government probably doesn't care that you're transferring privately owned wine that you'll end up taking back. But in the case of medicine, it's more complicated, because that, even one-on-one, they absolutely would prohibit because of the danger that's involved. So then you have to think about that a little bit more, although it's probably true that most medicine is not even really something you have to sell anyway. It's not really chametz gomer, so maybe that whole point may be a technicality. But in any event, the point I'm trying to make here is that however you answer that question, so I think we should be careful not to indulge too much in an attitude of, well, the wholesale is just a joke, so it doesn't really matter, or the wholesale is not going to be a problem because it'll be mochel. I think we should, to the best of our ability, take the attitude that this is an absolute 100% valid sale, and it's one that we will not take lightly and assume that we have the license to avail ourselves if we need to. And through that mentality, we should strengthen our sense of honesty and integrity in our business dealings, and it should be viewed as such and perceived as such, and that should help to bring about a full redemption speedily in our days. Okay, so I will we'll end here. God willing, next week, so we'll pick up on the corporations issues and how that affects a lot of areas, including what it means to be a stock owner, all of the implications, etc. And